Thank you, Ebony. Hi, my name is Kenna, and I'm an alcoholic. I am so impressed. Right, just... This is a real AA meeting, and you have carried a heavy message in the 20 minutes that Nancy and I have been here. You know, people just... Even that, I like it. Give them a good scolding. I'm a teacher. That speaks to my heart. Just, you know, I hope I never stop. I just turned 40 years sober, which is September 24th, 1985. It's kind of hard to believe, but it's true. And there was a point there somewhere. I don't know what. But I hope I never stop being impressed by Alcoholics Anonymous, and I certainly am tonight. And sometimes, you know, we love to talk about love or like, you know, where does, you know, AA, it's going to work some other time, other place out there somewhere. No, it is working right here, right now, in this moment, at this time, in this place. The view from here is fantastic. Or we're looking for these giant burning bushes and white light experiences. And absolutely those are there. But I don't want to forget, like, you know, Mark asked me to do this a while ago. I said I'd be here. He said he'd be here. We were both here. Somebody saved that spot for me to park. The lights were on. The chairs were set up. The coffee was made. There were people at the door looking their best, putting their hand out. You were smiling. You were welcoming. You were chatting. Like, that is no small thing, right? And from where we came from, it's actually not even possible. It's just not even possible. But yet, here it is. And if you're wondering if AA works... You are, here it is. It's working. And it's, you know, we often love to talk about love in the program, but we forget about manners. And boy, this meeting has not forgotten about manners. And it is those seemingly small things that really just, that carry a heavy message. So I thank you for the way that you carried the message to me tonight. And I just love being with you. It just really filled my heart. And I know Nancy, too, and thank you so much. Nancy, she came with me to Whittier last Friday. She's always willing to get in the car, and I really appreciate it. Gets a little lonely out there on the road, huh, Mark? But my life is good. I don't have any bad news about my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and that doesn't mean that I came here 40 years ago and, you know, worked the 12 golden steps and got Santa Claus for my God and never had another bad day. That's, you know, that would be absurd, right? That's not life on life's terms. Any, you know, it's the portion of every human life that if, you know, what I've gotten is the gift of being alive and being able to live it. But that means there's good times and there's bad times and there's bumps in the roads and there's times that seems like it's absolutely the end of the road, right? But I have been able to weather those things, because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I grew up in an alcoholic family. I grew up in Santa Cruz up north. Lots of alcoholism in my family. And that doesn't, you know, necessarily make me an alcoholic. But I do. I remember my first drink. I had older siblings. And when it hit my system, my first conscious thought was, oh, that's why they do this. They being like every adult in my life. Like, I got it. And the broken windows and the phone cut off and the Christmas lights up all year and the, you know, $200 cars with the wired on muffler and, you know, my dad going to jail sometimes or him being all beat up, you know, bloody in bed and laid up and all of that stuff, it suddenly was like nothing. Like, oh, because of what I felt. And I knew, okay, I get it now. You know, and there was still a lot of love in that home, even though, you know, there could also be chaos. And my dad moved out when I was, I don't know, 8 or 9 or something. He didn't go far. He moved in down the street with another woman and her kids, leaving my mom the librarian with these 4 kids to raise, you know, in my mom's hometown, right? And how embarrassing for her. And but it was my grandfather. My grandfather got sober sometime in the 1940s up in Humboldt County. That's where my dad's side of the family's from. I don't know how AA got behind the Redwood Curtain when it was barely even a decade old, but someone carried the message to my grandfather way up there in Eureka. And in his way, he carried the message to me. Even though I was 14 when he passed away, I had barely started to drink, but there was something sparkly about him. He had a ton of friends. And I knew he used to be like my dad, and he wasn't anymore. And when my dad left, it was my grandfather perhaps making living amends. He had not been able to be a provider or there for my dad. But he was for his grandkids and for his daughter-in-law. He helped my mom make the house payment, and she didn't lose that house. And he put braces on my teeth, and he paid tuition at the Catholic school that we went to. And so A was working in my life before I ever even knew the words or knew that I needed you. Because had he not been sober, things might have been very different. So you've been working in my life a long, long time, and my debt to you is enormous. And I love that Catholic school that I went to, and I don't think I'm recovering from that experience. And, you know, and I recognize many people had horrific experiences in the Catholic faith, but I had a very good one. The priests and the nuns were good examples of love and service. I got a good education there. I think, growing up in an alcoholic home, and then later even, you know, my mom trying to limp along as a single mom in the 70s with four kids, and, there was a lot of instability. And but I, you know, in that parish, I love putting on that uniform. You know, I knew it was a real anchor in my life. I can see that everything from like the ritual of the Mass to the kind of the structure of the parish and my school. And I'm a teacher today and understand that, you know, that structure is good for kids. And I thrive there. And it meant something to me. And I had a really good relationship with the God that I was introduced to there. And it was a great comfort to me in all that chaos that was going on in my childhood. That was the ground I stood on. And I tell you that tonight because when I began to take the actions of a young alcoholic woman, girl really, I had to lay down the thing that meant the most to me, my Catholic faith, the very ground that I stood on, because I could not reconcile the actions I was taking with the tenets of my faith, right? And alcoholism is going to demand whatever is nearest and dearest to you, it is going to demand that. And that is my experience. And by the way, if you're new, and I welcome you, this is not theory. That is not what we have here. What we have is experience. I think our stories are really powerful things because when I'm listening to your story, you know, there's nothing for me to argue against or point out why you're wrong or raise my fists up at. You're just telling me what happened to you. And in that, I often find that happened to me too. And I can pick up my bed and walk again, right? Backing up, morning after my eighth grade graduation, my mom's at the kitchen table. She's got my diploma. I'm the youngest of those four kids. I just graduated from that Catholic school, and unfortunately the Catholic high school had closed, and so I went there for 8 years, and I was on my way to Santa Cruz High. But my mother had gone there for 13 years to that Catholic school, and my grandmother and my great-grandmother, and we had deep roots in that parish. And my mom had my diploma and my little pins, and she said to me, "Ken, I finally got my scholar." And about a year and a half or so later, maybe two, I'm in front of my mom again, and things are a little different because I'd started to drink. I'm now behind the counter at the Duwiener Schnitzel. I've dropped out of high school with a 0.8 GPA, and my mom was there because I hadn't been home the night before. And she was standing there and trying not to cry, and she had that look of fear and heartbreak on her face that we see on the faces of our loved ones. And she was saying, "I don't understand. What has happened to you? You used to be so active." And she meant in our parish. But, you know, I am, alcohol fixes something to me that I need fixing, and I'm willing to pay a high price to have that fixing done, including breaking my mother's heart. I didn't know I was defending my right to drink at the time, but we do that, right? And I said to her, "You don't care, you know, leave me alone. I can't stand to see that look on your face, and I know I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing." Sometime before that, I had taken my first geographic, and seemed like my friends could just party on the weekends and end up back at school, and I wasn't able to do that. And I thought, you know what, it's Santa Cruz. It's a party town. If I go somewhere where I don't know anybody, I didn't know, of course, I was taking a geographic, and I didn't want to be unlearned, right? I didn't want to, I wanted to get an education, but I'm an alcoholic, and so I thought, my older sister, she was maybe had just turned 19, she was raising a little baby that she had at 18, so he was about maybe a toddler. She's sober today, was an alcoholic at that time. She went over to Honolulu, was on welfare, and was raising this baby on her own and drinking. And I thought, all right, I'll go move in with my older sister. I'll go to school every day because I won't know anybody, and I'll, you know, straighten up and do the right thing. But of course, you know, wherever you go, there you are. And didn't take very long. It seemed like the same people that were at Santa Cruz High were at Kaiser High in Honolulu, and I'm off and running again. And we ended up losing our apartment and staying on people's couches and stuff. Not technically homeless, but I remember about that time that nobody was ever happy to see us coming, right? These two teenage girls and a baby and some food stamps. And I'm not going to school now because I don't even know where I'm going to sleep that night. You know, I might be on this side of the island or that side of the island. I remember the Easter Sunday of that year, stepping off a city bus. I was by myself. I had all my belongings in a pillowcase, and I was going to stay somewhere with someone. I don't remember that part, but I remember this fleeting thought going by. My eye caught that pillowcase, and I thought, something's wrong. It's Easter Sunday. I should have been at Mass. I should be with my family. Like, something's wrong here, you know, but it just flashed by as it does. And I was in no way, you know, ready to look at what was wrong, which was the fact that I'm an alcoholic. And eventually we did find a place to live, but now I'm pregnant, and I terminated that pregnancy, and now I'm a bad girl, and I've done an unfixable thing. And it had just been maybe a year and a half or 2 years before that I'd been confirmed in the Catholic Church, and in that faith that meant so much to me. And that was a line I was never going to cross, and a principle I was never going to break. And very early on into my drinking, I'm crossing those lines, and I'm breaking those principles, and now I'm a bad girl, and I've got a secret. And so what do? You just drink, right? And I went back to California because Hawaii was the problem before. You know, Santa Cruz had been the problem. Hawaii's going to be the answer now. Hawaii's the problem. Santa Cruz will be the answer. And I tried to go back to high school one more time and ended up dropping out. And that's when I started working through the Wiener Schnitzel. And, you know, I didn't know when I took that job that I was going to do that work for the next 17 years. And the first 11 years of my sobriety, nothing wrong with it, but I was never happy doing it. And I am so grateful for sponsors and mentors and old timers that have insisted that I know the difference between a fantasy and a plan. I don't always like it, but I like the results that I get. I'm working at Duwiner Schnitzel. My best friend Pam, she had gotten fired from there, but then I was able to get her a job back again, and we're working there. And I started dating this guy, and he drank like I did. He woke up with the shakes like I did. His mom didn't say things like other moms were saying, like, you know, you can't come over here anymore. I think back on that night. Our first date was a double date, and it was my best friend Pam and I and these two guys. Both of those guys are dead. Neither of them made it to 50. And when I got sober in 85, Pam was strung out and living in a pickup truck and sneaking into UCSC to shower occasionally, or sometimes if I'd be in town, I'd drop off shampoo for her at the jail. And, you know, I think back on just on that night alone and those four teenagers and how incredibly lucky I am to get to stand here with the High Desert Group tonight in Lancaster, right? If I ever think it's not convenient to come from Pasadena to Lancaster, just that one night alone, how incredibly lucky I am. I lost the Drew Wiener Schnitzel job, by the way, which is possible. I think I quit just before I was fired, but I could see it was coming. I went and got a job with Great American Wiener Works. I showed them, and they served beer, and that was, you know, a step up. Now I'm stealing the beer from that place, and that relationship's getting crazy and violent, and I can't tell anybody what's going on. And I bought a car around this time, but like so many things when I was drinking, you know, ready, fire, aim, and I didn't even know how to drive. I found the car in the newspaper, got somebody to give me a ride, and eventually, you know, no driver's license, no registration, no insurance. I've gotten some big things in sobriety, as we can or do, you know, own a house and gotten an education, but I want you to know that my car is parked out there, and I have a license to drive it with my current address in my wallet. I have an insurance card that protects me and you, and I have tags on my plates, and I bought those tags with money that I earned. I didn't take a straight-edge razor blade and scrape those tags off anybody else's plates, right? I thought that freedom was in getting on an airplane, black eyes, sunglasses, one-way ticket, I'm out of here. Turns out freedom isn't doing, you know, the old Clancyisms of being where you say you're going to be when you say you're going to be there, doing what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. That sounds like stricture to me, right? I don't want to show up at the DMV. I don't want to, you know, but I like the freedoms that I get from that, right? I love getting pulled over. Isn't it great? I don't rarely, but when I do, yes, I have it all right here. So that I'm getting beat up by this guy, blackouts are crazy, the cars. I mean, by the time that was all done, the window was gone, there was big chunks of the carpet because there had been a fire, the tie rod was broken, whatever that was, there was no brake lights, but then there was no brakes, and I had this whole, like, downshifting, pumping the brakes, using the emergency brake, putting my foot out the door. God, it's no wonder we're so tired when we get here, right? Blackouts aren't so cute anymore. And I had a particularly bad week. I'd been beaten up pretty badly by this guy. And then I came to early in the morning, which wasn't a good sign. There was this weight on my chest. I knew it had something to do with my car. My car was in my mom's garage. There were pieces missing off it, which I've never found. I borrowed her car, picked up the newspaper to hit anyone or kill anyone. I'm driving around. I can't call my friends and say, hey, where were we last night? Ha, ha, ha. I don't even want them to know. I never found those missing pieces off that car. And within a matter of days, I'm back to Honolulu. Didn't tell that guy where I was going. Left the car for my mom to deal with. Black eye sunglasses hung over because now the problem and the solution, you know. And I'm got a job as a cocktail waitress in a bar in Hawaii, started making great money for an 18-year-old high school dropout. But I'm just crossing those lines. And by the time I'm 19, I'm on my fourth abortion. How has that happened? And I assure you, I had never planned on living that way. And I don't see any way that I can redeem what my life has become. And I have that Catholic education. I know those terms like grace and mercy and reconciliation, but there's no way that those things can be for me. I felt that I had placed myself beyond those things, right? I am lost to the comfort of any kind of conviction. And we have that long phrase here, pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. There's a shorter word that fits well to perdition, a nice Catholic word, spiritual ruin, loss of the soul. And those last couple years of my drinking, I was 22 when I got sober. I spent in that state of perdition, just wandering in that darkness, just so lost, right? And I think that's part of what makes the light so bright in here and why it impressed me so much tonight. Because when you have lived in that darkness, and I know we all have because I believe it's what drives us in here, and then you step into this light of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's really something. I'm dating a married man. I'm working at this bar. Last couple years of my drinking, I ended up drinking in the strip bars in Honolulu. I worked in Waikiki, and we used to go to each other's clubs and stuff, but I can't predict my behavior anymore, so it's just easier. I'm seeking lower companions. I'm lowering the bar. I'm drinking in those strip bars in the red light districts, and those bars are open until 4 a.m. They reopen at 6 a.m., and no one's going to want me to do anything like dance or have a conversation. And I could look at the women dancing on stage and think, at least I'm not doing that. And my married boyfriend started not want to come around to the way that I lived. And I just thought he was paranoid, but obviously we couldn't go to his house. And one afternoon he came over, and I was living in this apartment that was a lot like the house I grew up in, but it was between the Honolulu City bus yard and a freeway off-ramp, and there was broken out windows, and feral cats lived in that bus yard, and they'd come through those broken windows and eat out of our trash and spray all over, and there's this big wet spot in the carpet, and you know, I love that in the doctor's opinion where he says the alcoholic's problems pile up on him and become astonishingly difficult to solve. I don't know how to call the plumber. I don't know how to call the landlord. I just get better at jumping over the wet spot, right? This particular day, I had some stitches on my ankle because, you know, things happen. And my boyfriend came over and he said, look at your ankle. And it was covered with fleas. And, you know, I always want to make sure I share that when I speak, in case I ever think there's any glamour left in a cocktail for me. That is the 22-year-old, 85-pound young woman who came here with my hair falling out, my gums receded from malnutrition, and hearing voices and things crawling on my skin, and all that stuff that's happened such an end-stage alcoholism. And This day came for me, typical day, vomiting liver bile, racing brain. I had a bottle of vodka in the freezer. I'm trying to keep that down. And I started to pray that day, and I hadn't been able to do that in a long time. And I think that I picked up a rosary, had a rosary in one hand and the vodka in the other, and I found myself going to my phone, which was a payphone at the liquor store right by the freeway off-ramp. I couldn't go in that liquor store because I'd made a scene in there, so I would use their phone. But to get to the next closest liquor store, I'd run across that freeway off-ramp. I'd scramble up an embankment, cut through a hole in a chain-link fence, and, you know, we just make those adjustments, right? But I called my boss that day. I didn't really have anybody in my life to call. He was a drinking buddy. He came over. He took a look at me. I was sick and shaking. He said, let's go get a drink. And I said, no, take me to the hospital. And that's what he did. And I said, I saw a nurse before I saw the doctor. And I said to her, I can probably stop the cocaine, but I can't stop drinking. Boom. Admission of complete defeat. I can't stop drinking. And she said, my boyfriend's an alcoholic and he goes to AA. And I remember thinking, oh, it's not that bad. Hold on. And then I saw a doctor and he sent me on my way without the sympathy and the Valium that I thought I was entitled to. And he gave me a piece of paper, is my memory, with treatment centers on it and central office and stuff like that. And I remember going to the payphone at the liquor store, making some calls, and a woman saying, we don't have a bed, but we go to this place tonight. And I didn't even know where I was going or what it was. She just said, go to this place tonight. And it turned out it was an AA meeting at the Salvation Army Detox up on the Poly Highway. And now, why would I do that? Some random voice on the end of a payphone say, go to this place. There's only one time you can, when you're in a state of complete surrender and grace can arrive. And I was out of ideas. And I don't know how else to describe it, except it was what happened that night is what happened tonight. I stepped into the light, and I knew it. I knew you suffered from what I suffered from, and I could see you were free men and women, and I kept coming. And I got a sponsor, and I began to work these steps, and I began to get more comfortable in my skin. And I, when I had about 3 years sober, I moved to L.A. and floundered for a bit. And didn't get a home group, didn't get a sponsor, was just going to meetings when the heat was on, and I knew I was in a lot of trouble. And I was waiting tables with this Mary Ann King, fine member of the class of 1969. She's still alive. I'm her power of attorney. Just a little dementia now, but she saved my life. And I knew she was an active member of an active home group, and I kind of turned myself into her. And she said, there's a little meeting I go to Monday nights. Why don't you come? And thank God when Monday night came around, one more time, I'd been beaten into a state of reasonableness. I didn't have a better idea. And I followed her to that meeting and sat down next to her. And from there, you know, I got a sponsor. That was Karen Garrison, who absolutely saved my life. I could really hear Karen. And the first thing she said to me was, honey, I expect a lot from the people I sponsor. And I'm so glad that she said that, and I'm glad that she did, because I have risen to your level of expectation. And she said, you know, with your amount of sobriety, you're going to go to 4 meetings a week and get commitments at all of them and answer phones at central office, and we're going to go through the steps again and get an H&I commitment and call me on a regular basis. She had this whole list of stuff, and I remember thinking, I've picked the wrong sponsor. Like, those solutions had nothing to do with my problems. And, of course, a lot of those problems just died of neglect, and Karen absolutely knew what she was doing, which was that to get me in the middle of the room and put a foundation under me and a fellowship around me, two things that I'm solid with today. And how nice to stand on solid ground, right? And I have seen AA from the fringes, and I've seen it from the middle. And what I know to be true is that, you know, the views are entirely different, and my life works when I'm in the middle of you, period. That second inventory I did with Karen, a big thing that came out of that I could not have seen on my first inventory was that I was ashamed of the fact that I only had an eighth grade education, and I'm still waiting tables, and I felt really stuck. But now I'm in meetings like this, at podiums like these, that probably people like Clint, who I'm thinking of, you know, probably stood here, I'm sure. And, you know, his story, like, I was living in a garage, now I'm a lawyer. I'm like, oh my God, if I sit in enough of these meetings, I'll be a lawyer too. This is great. And Karen said, no, God only does for us what we can't do for ourselves. And get your high school diploma, take the GED exam. And I thought, That is ridiculous. I mean, one, I know I can't pass. And two, GED, I mean, how about a PhD, right? I'm either way too good for it or I can't possibly. And big lesson there, though, the action doesn't care how contemptuous you are of it. It just mattered that I took it. I thought that was stupid and lame and had no bearing on my life. But I was willing, thank God, for the gift to surrender, right? My sponsor, I have this much objectivity about my case. But she could see that that was something that mattered in my inventory. I don't have that kind of perspective. And that all I had to do was be willing. And I didn't even know it mattered to me until I had the letter in my hand for the state of California, 28 years old, saying, congratulations, you're a high school graduate. It's so much easier for me to be contemptuous of something and act like I don't care than possibly try and fail. And this is why I have a sponsor and why I'm current with a sponsor. I started going to community college. It was not the first. It was my third because I'm a great starter and I'm a terrible finisher. And you taught me how to finish, right? You taught me how to finish from those stupid commitments you had me take, from the, you know, the expectation that I show up, the be where I say I'm going to be. And in June of 97, it's been a long time now, I put on a cap and gown for the first time in my life. And, you know, I wasn't a rocket to stardom. I was 11 years sober and 33 years old. But I graduated from UCLA, and I got to give the commencement address at that graduation. My mom got to sit in the VIP section. She had her scholar back. It was a long wait from eighth grade to 33, but she took it. And then I took a job teaching special ed middle school that I knew was wrong, but it was just going to be this temporary job because I wanted to go to graduate school. A friend of mine in the program was teaching there, and I took that job at the suggestion of my sponsor, who by then was Marion Wallin. And it was definitely, you know, it was definitely rough year. But it was also, I'd never done something so satisfying. But I still had my plans for that next year. So I taught special ed middle school in Gardena, and then that next year I went up to Stanford and got a master's in English Lit. And I ended up on the faculty at the community college where my sponsor Karen had sent me to take one class, or where I'd call her from the phone booth and say, I'm scared to walk in today. And I was so sure that's what I wanted to do, but then I found it really, my heart was really, you know, that's why I got the fancy master's degree, but I found that my heart was really teaching special ed middle school, and that's what I do this day. I'm about a year away from retirement, and you know, I've had my periods of burnout. I've had, you know, times like, God, get me out of here, but many, many, many times over these last 25 years, when I'm doing the work I do, I don't want to be anyone else, and I don't want to be anywhere else. I feel comfortable and usefully whole. Now, for the chronically restless, irritable, and discontent, that's a pretty good state of affairs. Those pregnancies that I terminated that could not be made right, some slates cannot be wiped clean, but with willingness, God seems to find a way. And I was 20 years sober before it occurred to me. I've worked with a lot of unwanted kids, a lot of kids in the system, kids in group homes. The foster families don't want them, they're in group homes. Teachers certainly don't want them in their classrooms. And working with those unwanted kids has been a way for me to balance those scales with those unwanted pregnancies. And man, I could have missed it. If I would have said to Marion, because she said you could be of service there. I didn't want to hear that. I want God's will to be less of a commute. I don't want there to be some big kid in my face saying, oh, pimp slap you be. Like, I didn't want any of that. Thank God for the gift to surrender, right? Because I didn't miss that because it was life-changing. I was single, had some long-term relationships with a lot of old ideas about marriage, and then I just kind of thought that ship had sailed, and then I met Mike. Mike walked off of Skid Row at 53. His Social Security statement had 33 years of zero, so that gives you an idea. He did 28 years in the penitentiary. He walked off of Skid Row and into the Midnight Mission at 53 years old. And started working for Clancy on his first day in the mission. And as happens here, was transformed and became a really well-loved and respected member of my home group. And this is a sad story. And we had, when he had 6 years, we started dating. And a guy like that, having done that much time and at that age and stuff, should not have, you know, gotten sober. And he ended up being his parents' full-time caregivers and was part of his amends. But that happened, and a woman like me with my defended heart you know, stay away, should not have fallen head over heels out loud in love with this man, but those two improbable things happened. And we got engaged in 2015, and we bought a house. Like, are you kidding? Within about a month of being in the house, it was clear he was sick, and we'd been in the hospital trying, he had terrible insurance, and we're trying to navigate that, and then been in the hospital, and we knew it wasn't great, but not quite sure, and we came home, and our house was full of bed bugs, and we had to pack up stuff and tent the houses and stay in a hotel, and I'm carrying around this bag of medical records and calling in my sub plans and trying to get second opinions, and finally found out we were accepted to go to City of Hope. Like, great, world-renowned cancer hospital, 10 miles down the road, we're back on track, they'll fix it. And within like 10 minutes of our first visit, they said, you have 6 to 10 months. And we got 10 months. And I was like, no. First of all, why would God invite us to this banquet and take it away after like 3 bites? And secondly, that's not how this goes. I'm the high school dropout that went to Stanford. Like, that's how this is going to go. And the Serenity Prayer was great for, like, traffic on the way out here. But what about stuff that's unacceptable? This is unacceptable. You're asking me to accept this? And yes, actually, yes. Because we are engaged, and, you know, here's what anyone who's been around here knows, too, that this was the worst hard time. It's like the stars just fell out of the sky. But it was also this, I mean, sorrow doesn't come alone in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? It comes with all of you. And every single day of those 10 months, and I mean every single day, Mike and I would look at us just astounded because of some act of kindness, right? A bag of groceries left on the porch. I'd look out the window and his sponsor would be out there pulling weeds in our yard, you know? He didn't have an answer for liver cancer, but he could pull weeds like everybody did what they could, right? His best friend Lewis started a meeting for us in our backyard, and 20, 30 of you would come up our driveway every Thursday night, and I've never known fear like that. And the things that would take it away was you. You know, we were already engaged, and so we wanted to be married, and in whatever time we had left, and our home group put on a wedding for us in Clancy's backyard, and for 269 days, I was Mike's wife, and then he passed away in our home. My brother drove a camper down from Santa Cruz, and Mike's best friend, Lewis, moved into that camper. You should get him to speak, Lewis. Sorry, that's an aside. Lewis moved into that camper and helped, you know, Mike wanted to die at home, and we were going to make sure that happened, and help me care for him in the last, you know, days of his life. And, you know, these last few years I've been navigating that grief, and you know, it's a different walk for everybody, but for me it needed tending to, like alcoholism, and you know, what that looked like was I read a lot of books, and I went to a grief group for a couple years, and I went through the steps again, and I did a bereavement class at City of Hope, and I knew this, that no matter how far out into those dark waters I would have to wade, and I did, that one of you would be there, right, holding the lamp. Like, this is the way back. I've been here too, and this is the way back. And I don't know why I'm so, maybe this is the new 40-year sober me. I cry a lot. I don't know. Oh, look, thank you. You guys think of everything. You know, in January, I live right on the Pasadena-Altadena line, and in January, my neighborhood burned down, and not my house, partially. It's just a mess. I mean, I can look, everything across the street is gone, and I can look when I'm feeling sorry for myself, and I'm not dealing with what my neighbors are dealing with, but, you know, they're going to tear down some rooms in my house, and I'm living in a little back house right now. The whole known landscape of my day-to-day life is just erased. And that's a little unsettling, right? Bank, post office, hardware store, 22 square miles. And that time when Mike died, his dad died March 1st, Mike died March 28th, my dad died 7 days after that. We put our dog down 7 days after that. And then my oldest friend passed away that fall. You know, that's a lot of loss in a short period of time. Doesn't make me special, tragic, or a victim. It makes me in the game. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the ability to be a wife, a daughter, a friend, a daughter-in-law. I get to be in the game. And grief has its gifts. I would trade them all to have Mike with me tonight. That's not a trade I get to make. And you have taught me how that I have to learn to fit myself to the world and not demand that the world fit itself to me. You know, and sometimes you think, oh, it's going to be this way. Mike and I, and we'll, you know, and we bought this house in this lovely neighborhood, and then you're, you know, swallowed by a whale. And in the whale is, you know, liver cancer and unimaginable human suffering or an urban conflagration, and you're, like, fleeing through embers, and you're like, this isn't the way I want to go. This is not the ride I want to be on. Please take me back, right? But, again, not the choice that you get to make, and you're along for the ride. And those seemingly innocuous slogans that seem like nothing, like a day at a time, and boy, they take on a whole new weight in hard times, right? And I know there's people here that know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, this is a story and it should have a happy ending. I'm going to end with liver cancer and a fire. There is space for both, right? There is space for sorrow and anguish and grief, and space for gratitude and great love and vulnerability, some of the things that I've learned from grief. It's a very heart-opening experience, and I still don't have any bad news like I started tonight about my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really don't. I am certainly well overpaid, and, you know, my very first sponsor told me, like, you know, God is not Santa Claus. And it was like, but no, if I'm a good girl and do, won't I get, you know, that's not the deal. And, you know, I'm not sure how God works, but the dominant image in my faith is, you know, a broken and half-naked man on a cross. There's a message there about suffering. That's part of the deal too, right? And it doesn't all have to be suffering and all a veil of tears, but that's part of the deal too. And you have given me what I need to walk through it. And I want to thank you so much for taking this ride with me tonight, for being so present with me, for who you are tonight, for who you've been all the days leading up to this one and all the days to come. I will certainly need you. Newcomers, you stay right here. I love, there's a lot of things that I love this little line of poetry. Even after all this time, the sun never says to the earth, you owe me. Look what happens with a love like that. It lights the whole world. And I think that's such a beautiful definition of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, we want nothing from you, and you owe us nothing. If you want what we have, it is right here. We will lay out the tools for you and cheer you on and be in your corner. Please avail yourself of what's in this room. And thanks so much, you guys. Thanks for my life.